If you've ever prepared a kitchen for Passover, you know it is just, well, an exhausting microscopic hunt for every last breadcrumb.
Oh, absolutely. It's intense.
Right. You're staring at a pantry that feels like a hazardous material zone, just stressing over every single label and like half-open box of crackers.
Yeah, because the goal is absolute.
Exactly. You have to get rid of all the Chimettes, any leavened grain before the holiday even begins. But what if the secret to cutting your cleaning time in half isn't a new religious loophole, but a 1996 government regulation designed for celiac disease?
I mean, it sounds like a total mismatch of eras and purposes, honestly.
It totally does. But today we are taking a deep dive into an article by Chen Shaloff, and our mission is to explore how those two entirely different worlds collide.
Right. We're looking at the intersection of ancient Jewish law, specifically the really profound rulings of the 12th century philosopher Maimonides and modern food safety regulations in Israel regarding gluten labeling.
We are essentially exploring how an allergy warning on a box of cookies can act as this legal and religious shield for you.
Yeah, and to get there, we really have to unpack a deeply philosophical concept called nullification.
Which is just fascinating. It's the idea that a tiny fraction of a physical substance can, like, legally cease to exist.
It is. But before we get to the philosophy of it all, we have to define our terms.
Right.
Because both ancient law and modern health codes are hyper-focused on the exact same ingredients. Let's start with the ancient texts Shaloff cites. Chametz is incredibly
Oh,
specific.
it's not just any food, right?
Exactly. It only derives from five specific grains. You've got wheat, barley, oats, rye, and spelt, which is technically a hybrid of wheat.
Okay, but just having a bag of wheat flour in your pantry doesn't automatically make it Chametz, does it?
No, not at all. The transformation requires a very specific catalyst and a specific timeline.
Right.
They become forbidden only if they come into contact with water and sit for the time it takes an average person to walk a mile.
A mil being an ancient measurement of distance, right?
Yeah, which scholars calculate to be roughly 18 minutes.
18 minutes. And the texts also describe these very visceral physical signs of fermentation if you aren't sitting there watching the clock.
Right, because they didn't have timers back then.
Exactly. Like the dough makes a specific resonant sound when you slap it, or its surface pales and looks almost like hair standing on end.
It's very descriptive. The ancient scholars obviously didn't have microscopes to look for yeast
Well,
activity.
no, of course not.
So they had to rely on sensory human experience to determine when a chemical change actually occurred, and they mapped out some fascinating boundary lines based on that chemistry.
Like the exception for liquid contact.
Yes, there is a major exception in the law. If you take those exact same five grains and knead them exclusively with fruit juices, milk, wine, honey, or oil.
Meaning absolutely zero water is introduced.
Right, zero water. Then they never become Chimettes.
Because the yeast doesn't activate the same way without the water.
Exactly. The text notes the dough might spoil, I mean, it might rot and smell terrible.
Gross, but yeah.
But legally and chemically, it does not leaven. But the second a single drop of water enters the bowl, though, that 18-minute timer starts.
Wow. Okay, so fast forward centuries later to 1996, and a completely different authority targets those exact same grains.
Right, the Israeli Ministry of Health passes a gluten labeling law.
And this is a strict public health mandate to protect people with celiac disease.
Yeah, it's probably worth pausing to look at what is actually happening in a celiac patient's body when they consume these grains.
Oh, for sure. It isn't just an upset stomach.
Not at all. The gluten protein triggers an autoimmune response that basically inflames and attacks the lining of the small intestine.
It physically flattens the tiny hair-like projections, the villi that line the gut, right?
Exactly. And when those are damaged, the body is physically blocked from absorbing crucial nutrients.
Which leads to cascading severe issues like anemia and osteoporosis. The stakes are incredibly high.
Very high. Because the medical stakes are that high, the government had to draw a hard legal line defining which grains contain this dangerous gluten protein to mandate labeling.
And the list they generated is wheat, barley, rye, oats, and their hybrids like spelt.
Yep.
Okay, let's unpack this. The Venn diagram of what ancient Jewish law considers Chametz potential and what the modern Israeli government considers gluten is essentially a perfect circle.
It really is.
It's like two completely different operating systems, one religious, one medical, running the exact same source code.
That's a great way to put it. And because those ingredients perfectly overlap, it creates a very unique legal landscape.
How so?
Well, the modern government is measuring those gluten ingredients on a microscopic scale. So how does that modern measurement interact with the incredibly strict Passover rules.
Ah, and this is where we arrive at a highly practical takeaway for you, listening right now, standing in your kitchen staring at your pantry.
Exactly. So the modern Israeli health law mandates that if a product contains more than 20 parts per million of gluten...
Pepper per million.
Yeah, the manufacturer must explicitly state contains gluten in the allergen information.
And 20 parts per million is what, just 0.0002% of the product?
Yes. That tiny fraction is the legal threshold for bodily harm. Now, if a product is manufactured in Israel or officially imported under these specific Ministry of Health rules and it is labeled gluten-free,
meaning it passed good manufacturing practice.
Right. Or if it simply doesn't list gluten or those 5 grains in the allergens, the gluten content is virtually non-existent.
It is definitively below that 20 parts per million threshold.
Exactly. And Shalov presents a massive takeaway here. Because that threshold is vanishingly low, he argues these products fundamentally do not contain Chametz.
Oh.
Therefore, you do not have to throw them away.
So keeping them in your home does not violate the strict Passover prohibitions of Bal Yireh, meaning the Chametz shall not be seen, and Bal Yimatzeh, meaning it shall not be found in your possession.
That's his argument. Now, Shalov does add a caveat.
I was going to say, there's got to be a catch.
Right. Well, you can absolutely keep these non-Passover certified products in your house without violating the law. You probably shouldn't eat them during the holiday.
Okay, why not?
It's a measure of extra caution, just in case a factory made a rare labeling error. You are essentially keeping them in quarantine.
Okay, that makes sense. But I want to challenge the mathematical discrepancy here, though.
Go for it.
We are talking about 20 parts per million, 0.002% as a negligible amount in modern law. But later in the text, when discussing ancient Jewish law's rules for accidental mixtures, the standard threshold for nullifying a forbidden substance is 1 part in 60.
Right, 1/60.
1/60 is roughly 1.5%. That is a massive difference. Why is a 1.5% contamination rate perfectly fine in ancient religious law, but a 0.002% rate triggers modern health warnings?
It comes down to the fundamental difference between human immune response and culinary reality.
Meaning?
Modern medicine tracks autoimmune triggers at a microscopic cellular level. Like we said, even 0.0002% of a protein can trigger a physical attack on the small intestine.
Right, the body knows it's there even if we don't.
Exactly. Ancient dietary law, however, is built on the human experience of food. Maimonides and the sages were asking very different questions.
Like, does this trace ingredient alter the taste? Does it change the structure of the dough?
Yes. At 1.5%, a stray ingredient is usually completely undetectable to the human palate.
So both systems are establishing a threshold of significance. They are just measuring it in entirely different domains.
You nailed it. Which brings us directly to how Maimonides handled these culinary accidents.
Right. When a tiny bit of something strictly forbidden accidentally mixes into a huge amount of something permitted.
Exactly. He outlines distinct rules for nullification, dividing them into two categories. The first category involves mixtures of different kinds.
In Hebrew, that's min bishinomino, right?
Yes. The classic example is if forbidden pig's milk accidentally mixes into a permitted vegetable stew, you have two completely different substances colliding.
And in that scenario, Maimonides rules that by Torah law, the mixture is completely permitted as long as the taste of the forbidden item cannot be detected.
Right.
If you taste the stew and it just tastes like vegetables, the forbidden milk is essentially ignored. The law relies entirely on human perception.
But the problem arises with the second category. Mixtures of the same kind, or min bilamino.
Oh, like if forbidden pig's milk accidentally mixes into a vat of kosher cow's milk.
Exactly. You can't rely on taste anymore because, well, milk tastes like milk. Your senses can't save you.
So when perception fails, you rely on math. And this is where that 1 in 60 rule comes into play.
Yep. It requires a mathematical nullification by majority.
The article breaks this down clearly. 1/60 is roughly 19 grams of an item mixed into 170 grams of permitted food.
Right. If the forbidden item is less than 1.5% of the total volume, it legally ceases to exist. It's a really profound way of looking at the physical world.
It acknowledges that trace elements don't define the identity of the whole. Here's where it gets really interesting. It's like dropping a single drop of red dye into an Olympic-sized swimming pool.
Oh, I like that analogy.
Thanks. I mean, a chemist could take a water sample to a lab, put it under a microscope, and prove the red dye molecules are still physically there.
Sure.
But if a lifeguard looks at the water and sees blue, the pool is legally blue. The law cares about the human experience of the pool, not the microscopic reality. The dye has been nullified.
That mechanism works beautifully for everyday dietary laws. But Passover introduces a massive contradiction to this whole system.
It does.
Yeah. During the week of Passover, chametz is treated like absolute toxic waste. The text notes that during the holiday, chametz is forbidden b'mashehu, meaning even a microscopic, imperceptible amount ruins an entire batch of food.
So the 1 in 60 rule is completely thrown out the window.
Completely.
But why the sudden change in the rules? I mean, if mathematical dilution works all year round, why does a single crumb suddenly have the power to ruin a whole kitchen during Passover?
The answer hinges on a brilliant legal concept called Devar Sheyesh Lo Matarin.
Which translates to something that has permitters, right? Or something that will eventually become permitted.
Exactly. Because Passover is only 7 days long, the prohibition actually has an expiration date.
Oh, I see.
The sages looked at the situation and reasoned, why rely on a mathematical loophole, the 1 in 60 rule, to eat this slightly contaminated food right now?
Because you can just wait a week and then chametz will be perfectly legal to eat again.
Precisely. Because a built-in permitter already exists, meaning time, the sages removed the leniency of mathematical nullification. During the holiday, you must be absolute.
Okay, but Shalov's core argument hinges on the timeline of that absolute zero tolerance rule.
It does.
He argues the strictness only applies if the mix-up happens during Passover. Let's say 15 grams of regular chametz falls into a kilo of matzah dough weeks before the holiday even begins.
Right.
Shalov argues that mixture is completely nullified by the 1 in 60 rule.
Yes. We see how timing dictates reality here. Before Passover begins, chametz is not a forbidden substance. It is just regular permitted food.
Okay.
If it gets diluted then, it loses its identity before it ever becomes illegal.
Because the substance was diluted into non-existence while it was still perfectly mundane?
Exactly. Therefore, when the calendar shifts and Passover actually begins, there is legally no chametz in that dough to forbid. It's already gone.
The critics mentioned in the text push back hard on this, though. They argue that, according to Jewish law, only a forbidden item can be nullified by a permitted item.
Right.
Since the chametz wasn't forbidden before Passover, they claim it couldn't formally undergo the legal process of nullification.
And this brings us to the theory of chozer vinyar, which means reawakening.
Reawakening. Like a zombie.
Kind of. The opponents argue that when the holiday starts and chametz officially becomes illegal, that tiny trace amount in the dough suddenly wakes up, regains its identity as chametz, and ruins the whole batch.
So if you're standing in your pantry holding that bag of gluten-free Israeli chips on the first night of Passover, the critics are saying a microscopic trace of wheat could suddenly wake up like a zombie crumb and ruin your holiday compliance.
That's what they argue. But Shalov forcibly rejects this reawakening theory, and he actually uses Maimonides' own logic to dismantle it.
Oh, how so?
He brings two specific proofs from entirely different areas of Jewish law to show that once something is nullified by a majority, it stays dead. It does not wake up.
Okay, let's go through them. The first proof deals with the strict separation of meat and milk.
Right.
Shalov points out a scenario where a tiny piece of kosher meat accidentally falls into a completely neutral non-meat mixture, say, a huge pot of plain vegetables.
Yep. And because it's less than 1/60th of the volume, it gets mathematically nullified. The meat essentially loses its identity as meat because it was completely overwhelmed by the majority.
So following that logic, you could later take that vegetable mixture and cook it with milk. If the reawakening theory were true, the moment the milk hits the pot, that tiny trace of meat would theoretically wake up and create a forbidden meat and milk mixture.
But the law says it doesn't.
The meat's identity was permanently erased the moment it was diluted. It can't suddenly become meat again just because a new element is introduced.
Spot on. Now, the second proof involves the really complex laws of personal vows, and it operates on the exact same mechanism.
Yeah.
Imagine a person takes a strict vow stating, I will not eat this specific type of fruit for one day.
Right.
Unbeknownst to them, a tiny bit of that exact fruit had already been mixed into a large dish they were served earlier, and its taste was completely undetectable.
Under the laws of vows, the person is still allowed to eat the dish. The fruit is nullified relative to the vow.
Right.
Making a promise today doesn't retroactively reach back in time and wake up the fruit's identity from a previously established mixture.
The underlying architecture of the law is just remarkably consistent.
It is. But, I mean, I'm still stuck on the physical reality of this, though.
How do you mean?
Well, a critic could say, we aren't talking about abstract promises. We're talking about a physical crumb of bread in a bowl of dough.
Sure.
If I take a sample of that dough and put it under a high-powered microscope, the wheat molecules are sitting right there. How can Maimonides and Shalhoub argue that a physical object just, like, legally evaporates?
It's a fair question, but it requires us to step outside our modern hyper-scientific literalism.
Okay.
What this text reveals is an ancient legal framework where reality isn't defined by absolute microscopic physical presence. Reality is defined by dominant majorities.
Right.
Once a substance completely loses its identity to an overwhelming majority, it cannot spontaneously regain its identity just because the calendar changed and a holiday started.
Because the majority has permanently rewritten the reality of that mixture.
Yeah.
The trace element doesn't have the power to assert itself against the whole.
Exactly.
Wow. We have covered an incredible span of thought here. I mean, we started with a very relatable modern stressor, exhaustively cleaning out your pantry for Passover.
A nightmare for many.
Truly. And we trace a journey from a 1996 Israeli Ministry of Health mandate protecting celiac patients all the way back to the 12th century philosophical frameworks of Maimonides regarding the very nature of existence and identity.
It really highlights the continuity of human problem solving. The specific mechanisms evolve, sure.
From relying on human taste and math to lab testing for parts per million?
Exactly. But the underlying logic remains focused on finding practical thresholds for human behavior.
So the ultimate takeaway for you as you look at your own pantry is highly practical.
Very much so.
If an Israeli product is officially labeled gluten-free or doesn't list the 5 grains under the health ministry's rules, it is legally chametz-free. You can keep it in your house without violating the holiday rules.
And on a deeper level, if a tiny bit of chametz accidentally mixes into your food before the holiday begins, the 1-in-60 rule nullifies it forever. It does not wake up.
Which fundamentally changes the way you look at those mundane labels on the back of a cereal box or a bag of chips. You aren't just looking at nutritional information or modern allergy warnings. You are looking at a legal shield built on centuries of rigorous logic.
These ancient, seemingly rigid dietary laws actually contain profound release valves for dealing with the messy, accidental reality of human life.
Yeah, the concept of nullification exists so that a single microscopic mistake doesn't destroy an entire system.
It's a very beautiful acknowledgement of human limitation.
It is. Which leaves us with a final thought to ponder long after this deep dive ends. If ancient religious law and modern scientific law both agree that at a certain microscopic level, whether that's 20 parts per million or 1 in 60 a substance, completely loses its fundamental identity and its power over us,
yeah.
What other overwhelming things in our lives might work the same way? Think about our daily stressors, our anxieties, or toxic influences.
Oh, it's interesting.
Might they be completely nullified if we just dilute them enough with an overwhelming majority of the good stuff?
Mm.
Maybe the bad stuff doesn't have to vanish entirely from the universe to lose its power over you. It just needs to be massively outmeasured.